A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been rolling with the sleep deprivation thing since Ezra arrived. We talked about the brain maintenance angle before. Now he's asking about the physical side. Specifically, why does bad sleep leave you feeling clammy, off, almost hungover in your body, not just your head? He says it's hard to describe, but it's this subtle physical imprint that lingers all day. And he's wondering whether that's just him, or whether there's actual physiology behind it.
Oh, it's absolutely not just him, and the physiology is genuinely wild once you start pulling it apart. The short version is that poor sleep essentially puts your autonomic nervous system into a kind of low-grade fight-or-flight state that never fully resolves. You're walking around with your sympathetic nervous system idling too high.
You're physically stressed without feeling stressed.
Exactly the paradox. Your body's stress response is humming along at, say, 60% when it should be at 20, but you don't consciously register it as anxiety or panic. You just feel... That clammy feeling Daniel described is actually a really precise diagnostic observation. It's what happens when your sweat glands are getting nudged by sympathetic nerve fibers that are more active than they should be.
The body's version of a check engine light that's been on so long, you forget what the dashboard looked like without it.
Here's the thing most people don't realize. Your sweat glands have two completely different nerve supplies. One's for thermoregulation, the other's for emotional sweating. The emotional sweat pathway runs through the sympathetic nervous system and it's cholinergic, not adrenergic. So it's using acetylcholine, not adrenaline, which is why you can get that cold, clammy sweat even when you're not hot.
Wait, so there is a separate wiring system for stress sweat versus heat sweat?
Thermoregulatory sweating is driven by the hypothalamus tracking your core temperature. Emotional sweating originates in the limbic system, the amygdala and anterior cingulate, and it preferentially hits your palms, soles, and forehead. That's why your hands get clammy when you're nervous, but not when you're hot. And sleep deprivation essentially lowers the threshold for that emotional sweating pathway to activate.
The clamminess Daniel's feeling is basically his limbic system sweating for no reason.
Not for no reason. For a very specific reason that we can trace to a structure in the brain called the locus coeruleus. It's this tiny cluster of neurons in the brainstem that's basically the brain's main supplier of norepinephrine. During wakefulness, it fires at a steady rate. During deep, slow-wave sleep, it goes almost completely silent. That silence is what allows your sympathetic nervous system to reset its baseline.
If you're not getting enough deep sleep,
then the locus coeruleus never gets its quiet period. It keeps firing day after day at a rate that's slightly too high. And because norepinephrine has a half-life in the synapse, it hangs around. You end up with what researchers call elevated sympathetic tone. Your blood vessels are slightly more constricted. Your sweat glands are slightly more primed. Your heart rate variability drops, which is one of the most reliable biomarkers of sleep quality we have.
I've heard you mention heart rate variability before. Remind me what that actually tracks.
It's the variation in time between each heartbeat. High variability means your heart is responsive, flexible. It speeds up when you inhale, slows when you exhale. That's healthy. Low variability means your heart is beating more like a metronome, which sounds good, but is actually a sign that the sympathetic nervous system is dominating and the parasympathetic can't get a word in. Sleep deprivation tanks heart rate variability. We're talking drops of 20 to 30% after just one night of poor sleep.
You're less physiologically flexible. Your body can't adapt moment to moment.
And that rigidity shows up everywhere. Your blood pressure doesn't dip properly at night. Your cortisol rhythm gets flattened. Cortisol is supposed to peak about 30 to 45 minutes after you wake up. It's called the cortisol awakening response, and then declines steadily through the day. Poor sleep scrambles that. You might get a blunted morning peak, or a peak that comes late, or cortisol that stays elevated into the evening when it should be bottoming out.
Which would explain the hangover comparison. It's not just a metaphor.
It's barely a metaphor. The mechanisms overlap substantially. Alcohol disrupts sleep architecture in ways that look a lot like natural sleep deprivation, and both conditions produce elevated inflammatory cytokines. There's a study from UCLA. Matthew Walker's group looked at this, where one night of sleep restricted to 4 hours caused a measurable spike in interleukin-6 and tumor necrosis factor alpha. Those are the same inflammatory markers you see in people who are fighting off an infection.
You're literally mildly inflamed.
And inflammation has a particular sensory signature that people often struggle to describe. It's not pain exactly, it's this diffuse sense of being unwell, malaise, heaviness, a feeling that something is off. The technical term is sickness behavior. Your immune system is essentially sending signals to your brain saying something's wrong, and your brain responds by making you feel physically lousy, even if there's no pathogen.
That's the forward reaction line right there. Your body is acting sick without being sick.
The clammy skin fits perfectly into that picture. When your body is mounting even a mild inflammatory response, it resets your hypothalamic thermostat. Your core temperature set point shifts slightly upward, which makes you feel chilled at normal room temperature. So you get this weird combination of feeling cold and clammy at the same time because your body is trying to conserve heat, but your skin is also slightly moist from that elevated sympathetic drive.
That's the sensation he's describing. Cold and damp, like you're slightly leaky.
There's also a glucose angle here that doesn't get enough attention. Sleep deprivation impairs insulin sensitivity. After just a few nights of restricted sleep, your pancreatic beta cells start overproducing insulin because your tissues aren't responding to it properly. The result is blood sugar swings that most people don't attribute to sleep. You eat breakfast, your blood sugar spikes higher than it should, then crashes harder. That crash produces its own set of physical symptoms, shakiness, sweating, that hollow, shaky feeling.
The 3 p.m. slump, but it's actually the 10 a.m. slump, and it never really goes away.
Poor sleep tonight makes your glucose regulation worse tomorrow, which makes you feel physically terrible, which makes it harder to sleep the next night. It's a vicious cycle that's remarkably hard to break once you're in it.
Let me pull these threads together. The clamminess is sympathetic overdrive hitting sweat glands. The heaviness is inflammatory cytokines doing their sickness behavior thing. The shakiness is glucose dysregulation. And all of it traces back to the locus coeruleus, never getting its quiet time.
That's the core loop. But there's another layer that's even more directly relevant to Daniel's situation, the 6 a.m. wake-up pattern. Because the timing of sleep disruption matters enormously for how your body feels the next day.
He said Ezra wakes at 6, goes back down for a couple hours, and they're getting enough total duration, but still feel hungover.
The last 2 to 3 hours of a typical night's sleep are disproportionately rich in REM sleep. REM sleep dominates the early morning hours. If you're consistently getting woken up right at the threshold of the REM heavy period, even if you go back to sleep afterward, you're fragmenting the most physiologically active phase of sleep.
REM is where what happens, exactly.
REM does several things, but for our purposes, the key one is emotional and autonomic recalibration. During REM, your brain essentially decouples norepinephrine entirely. The locus coeruleus goes completely silent, even more so than in deep sleep. It's the only time in your entire 24-hour cycle where norepinephrine levels in the brain drop to near zero. That absence allows your noradrenergic receptors to reset their sensitivity.
If you're missing REM, your receptors stay desensitized.
Or oversensitized, depending on the receptor subtype. The net effect is that your stress response system loses its calibration. It's like a thermostat that's been nudged slightly off. The room feels wrong, but you can't point to a specific number that's wrong. Your body's entire stress signaling apparatus is operating from a shifted baseline.
The thermostat analogy works on multiple levels here. Body temperature regulation gets weird with sleep loss too, right?
Sleep deprivation impairs your ability to dissipate heat through your extremities. Normally, when you're falling asleep, your hands and feet vasodilate. Blood vessels open up, you dump heat through your palms and soles, and your core temperature drops by about half a degree Celsius. That's the signal your brain uses to initiate and maintain sleep. If you're sleep deprived, that vasodilation response gets blunted. Your hands and feet stay cooler, your core stays warmer, and your body can't find its thermal equilibrium.
You're physically stuck in a between state, neither fully at rest nor fully alert.
Thermal discomfort has its own direct link to that clammy feeling. When your core to periphery temperature gradient is off, your body keeps oscillating between trying to conserve heat and trying to dump it. You get these micro bursts of vasodilation followed by vasoconstriction. The result is patchy, inconsistent skin temperature and moisture. 1 minute your hands feel cold and dry, the next they're slightly damp.
Which maps perfectly to what Daniel described. This vague, hard-to-pin-down physical wrongness that follows you through the day.
There's a 2024 study from the University of Helsinki that looked at exactly this. They tracked skin conductance, heart rate variability, and subjective physical discomfort in people after nights of fragmented versus consolidated sleep. The fragmented sleep group showed elevated skin conductance. That's a direct measure of sweat gland activity for up to 14 hours after waking. That's the entire waking day.
The body is literally measurably different after fragmented sleep. It's not in your head.
It's objectively measurable, and the participants in that study had a really hard time articulating what they felt. The most common descriptors were, not myself, heavy, foggy, but in my body. Very few of them said tired. The physical sensations dominated over the cognitive ones.
Tired is a brain word. What they're describing is a body state.
That distinction matters because it points to different underlying mechanisms. The cognitive fog of sleep deprivation is largely about adenosine accumulation and reduced prefrontal cortex activation. The physical malaise is about autonomic dysregulation and low-grade inflammation. They overlap, but they're not the same thing.
Let me ask the obvious follow-up. Is there anything you can actually do about the physical side, short of getting perfect sleep?
There are a few things that have decent evidence behind them. The most counterintuitive one is morning light exposure. Not just for circadian reasons, though that's important, but because bright light in the morning directly activates the sympathetic nervous system's daily calibration. It essentially gives your autonomic system a clean, this is morning, signal, which helps reestablish the proper day-night contrast even if your sleep was poor.
Step outside first thing, even if you feel terrible.
Ideally within 30 minutes of waking for at least 10 to 15 minutes. The light needs to hit your retinal ganglion cells directly to trigger the IPRGC pathway that talks to your suprachiasmatic nucleus. It won't fix everything, but it will help your body distinguish between. I feel bad because I slept badly, and I feel bad because something is seriously wrong.
The body's version of turning it off and on again.
A surprisingly apt comparison. Another one is temperature manipulation. A brief cold exposure, not extreme, just a 30-second blast of cold water at the end of your shower triggers a sympathetic-parasympathetic rebound. Your sympathetic system spikes briefly, then your parasympathetic system kicks in to bring it back down. That rebound is what you're after. It essentially forces a recalibration of your autonomic balance.
You're shocking the system into remembering what normal feels like.
The technical term is vagal activation. The vagus nerve is the main highway of the parasympathetic nervous system, and cold exposure is one of the most reliable ways to stimulate it. After the cold shock, vagal tone increases for hours. Heart rate variability improves. Skin conductance drops. It's not a cure, but it measurably moves the needle on several of the physical markers we've been talking about.
What about the glucose piece? Anything help with the blood sugar swings?
This one's tricky because sleep deprivation actually changes your food preferences. There's robust evidence that sleep loss increases cravings for high glycemic, high fat foods. Your ghrelin goes up, your leptin goes down, and your endocannabinoid system. Yes, the same one cannabis acts on gets amplified. You're chemically driven to reach for a pastry.
The body is actively sabotaging itself.
In the short term, it kind of makes sense. Your brain is energy depleted and it wants quick glucose. The problem is that quick glucose makes the physical symptoms worse by amplifying the blood sugar roller coaster. The counterintuitive move, and there's decent evidence for this, is to eat something with protein and fat first thing, before any carbohydrates. It blunts the glucose spike and gives your compromised insulin response less work to do.
Uh-oh. Eggs, not cereal.
A study from the University of Chicago had sleep-deprived participants eat either a high-protein or high-carb breakfast, and the protein group showed significantly more stable blood glucose across the following 4 hours. Their self-reported physical discomfort was also lower, though that's subjective.
All of this makes me think about how sleep deprivation is almost never discussed as a whole-body phenomenon. The cultural conversation is always about brain fog, concentration, productivity.
It's a massive blind spot. The brain-centric framing of sleep has dominated public understanding for decades, partly because cognitive performance is easier to measure, and partly because the subjective experience of feeling mentally slow is more salient to most people. But the body is keeping score the whole time. Every organ system has a circadian rhythm. Your liver, your kidneys, your gut, your skin, they all have peripheral clocks that are synchronized by the master clock in the suprachiasmatic nucleus, and sleep disruption desynchronizes all of them.
The liver has a clock.
The liver has a profoundly important clock. It regulates glucose production, lipid metabolism, detoxification enzymes, all on a roughly 24-hour cycle. When you fragment your sleep, the liver clock starts drifting relative to the brain clock. It's like having two metronomes that are slightly out of phase. The result is metabolic inefficiency. Your liver is releasing glucose at times when your muscles aren't primed to take it up, or producing cholesterol when your clearance pathways aren't active.
The physical feeling is partly your organs being out of sync with each other.
That's a big part of it. And the skin is an organ too, the largest one. It has its own circadian clock. At night, skin permeability increases, blood flow changes, and repair processes ramp up. Sleep deprivation disrupts all of that. There's even evidence that skin barrier function is compromised after poor sleep, which can contribute to that clammy off sensation. Your skin is literally not maintaining itself properly.
The skin is an organ. I feel like people forget that constantly.
They absolutely do. And it's an organ that's densely innervated with sensory fibers that are constantly reporting back to your brain about temperature, moisture, pressure. When those signals are abnormal, because your skin's physiology is slightly off, your brain registers it as a diffuse sense of physical wrongness. You can't point to it because it's not localized. It's everywhere.
Like the body's equivalent of room tone in a recording. You don't notice it until it's wrong.
That's a beautiful way to put it. And when it's wrong, everything feels slightly off, even if you can't articulate why.
Let me circle back to something you said earlier about REM and norepinephrine. If the 6 a.m. wake-up is consistently eating into REM, is there a cumulative effect that's different from just general sleep deprivation?
Yes, and this is where Daniel's specific situation gets interesting. REM sleep debt accumulates differently than slow-wave sleep debt. If you lose slow-wave sleep one night, your brain prioritizes it the next night. You get more deep sleep. It's called slow-wave rebound. REM sleep doesn't show the same kind of immediate homeostatic rebound. It takes longer to recover, and the recovery is often incomplete.
You can be getting enough total sleep and still be in REM debt.
For weeks or months. And REM debt has a specific physiological signature. Studies on selective REM deprivation, where researchers wake people up every time they enter REM but let them get plenty of deep sleep, show that the autonomic effects are particularly pronounced. Heart rate variability stays suppressed. Cortisol rhythms stay flattened. The physical symptoms linger even when the cognitive symptoms improve.
Which would explain why Daniel's still feeling it, even though Ezra's sleep patterns have improved from the newborn phase.
The duration is there, but the architecture is still disrupted at a critical transition point. 6 a.m. is right in the sweet spot of the REM dominant period. Even a brief awakening, even if you fall back asleep within minutes, fragments that REM bout. And fragmented REM is not the same as continuous REM. The restorative autonomic effects require sustained, uninterrupted REM episodes.
What's the minimum continuous REM you need for it to do its job?
We don't have a hard threshold, but there's evidence that REM bouts shorter than about 10 minutes don't produce the same norepinephrine suppression. The locus coeruleus needs sustained silence to reset. If you're getting woken up every 30 or 40 minutes during the REM-rich early morning period, you might accumulate REM minutes on paper but get almost none of the autonomic benefit.
The sleep tracker says you got REM, but your body disagrees.
Sleep trackers are terrible at this, by the way. They estimate sleep stages from heart rate and movement, which are proxies. They can't directly measure what's happening in the locus coeruleus. You could have a tracker telling you you got 90 minutes of REM and be walking around with the autonomic profile of someone who got half that.
Quantified wellness strikes again.
The number becomes the thing, and the actual physiology gets ignored.
What's the practical takeaway here for someone in this situation? You've got a kid who predictably wakes at 6. You can't change that. What can you do to minimize the physical hangover?
A few things that have some evidence. First, protect the sleep you do get after the wake-up. If Ezra goes back down at 6:15 and you can sleep until 8, make those last 2 hours as uninterrupted as possible. That means no checking your phone at the 6 a.m. wake-up. The blue light plus the cognitive activation of reading messages will suppress melatonin and spike cortisol, making it harder to get back into REM.
You're basically protecting the REM window by not fully waking your brain up.
Stay in as low a state of arousal as possible. Don't turn on lights. Don't look at screens. If you have to interact with the baby, do it in near darkness. The goal is to keep your brain in a state where it can slide back into REM quickly rather than having to reinitiate the whole sleep onset process. Strategic napping, but with a specific protocol. A nap of about 20 minutes, no longer, in the early afternoon can reduce the sympathetic overdrive without causing sleep inertia or interfering with nighttime sleep. The key is timing. Nap too late or too long and you'll reduce sleep pressure for the night, which makes the problem worse. But a short nap between 1 and 3 p.m. can act as a sympathetic reset button. This one's less studied, but mechanistically plausible, evening carbohydrate timing. There's some evidence that a small carbohydrate-rich snack about an hour before bed can increase the proportion of REM sleep in the first half of the night by raising insulin and shifting tryptophan transport across the blood-brain barrier. The effect is modest, but for someone who's REM-deprived, it might help. I'd emphasize small, though. A banana, not a bowl of pasta.
The body's physical hangover from bad sleep is real, measurable, and driven by at least 4 overlapping mechanisms. Sympathetic overdrive from a noisy locus coeruleus. Inflammatory cytokines producing sickness behavior. Glucose dysregulation from impaired insulin sensitivity. And thermal dysregulation from a scrambled circadian clock. Plus REM-specific autonomic debt. If your disruption hits the early morning window.
That's a remarkably tidy summary. The only thing I'd add is that all of these mechanisms are bidirectional. The physical symptoms make it harder to sleep well the next night, which deepens the dysregulation. Breaking the cycle usually requires intervening on the physical side, not just the sleep side. That's why the morning light and the cold exposure and the protein breakfast matter. They're not sleep interventions. They're autonomic interventions that happen to make sleep better downstream.
Which is a useful reframing. Most sleep advice is about what you do before bed. This is about what you do after waking up to tell your body that the day has actually started.
That reframing is especially relevant for parents, because the pre-bed stuff is often out of your control. You can't guarantee uninterrupted sleep, but you can control what happens in the first hour after you get up for the day. That's the leverage point.
You mentioned the Helsinki study showing elevated skin conductance for 14 hours after fragmented sleep. Is there any evidence that these effects compound over weeks or months?
There is, and it's concerning. Longitudinal studies on shift workers, who are basically living in a state of chronic circadian disruption, show that autonomic dysfunction becomes progressively worse over time. After years of shift work, heart rate variability doesn't fully recover even during vacation. There's a kind of allostatic load that accumulates. Whether that applies to the milder disruption of early parenthood is less clear, but the mechanisms are the same, just at lower intensity.
The wear and tear on the body from being asked to adapt over and over again.
That's exactly what it is. And the physical sensations Daniel's describing, the clamminess, the vague wrongness, those are the subjective experience of allostatic load. It's the body saying it's been adapting too hard for too long.
The answer to "is it just me?" is a pretty definitive no. It's not just you. It's your autonomic nervous system running an ultramarathon it never signed up for.
The fact that he noticed it and described it as precisely as he did, clammy, hard to articulate, physical rather than mental, suggests a level of interoceptive awareness that most people don't have. He's picking up on real physiological signals that are there.
That's the ability to sense your own internal body states.
Some people are terrible at it. They can't tell you if their heart is beating fast or slow, if they're hot or cold, if their stomach is full or empty. Other people are highly attuned to those signals. Daniel seems to be in the second group. The signals are real. He's just one of the people who notices them.
Which is a gift and a curse in this context.
When your body is functioning well, high interoceptive awareness is great. When your body is sending distress signals you can't do much about, it's just another source of discomfort.
Before we wrap, let me ask one more thing. Is there any scenario where this physical hangover is actually a sign of something more serious that people should get checked out?
That's a fair question. In most cases, what we're describing is a normal physiological response to inadequate sleep. But if someone consistently feels physically terrible after what should be adequate sleep, let's say 7 or 8 hours, mostly uninterrupted, then it's worth looking at other possibilities. Sleep apnea is the big one. It fragments sleep without you being consciously aware of it, and it produces exactly this cluster of physical symptoms: morning headache, clammy skin, feeling unrefreshed. Restless leg syndrome can do something similar. And there are some autonomic disorders that can mimic these symptoms.
If the sleep duration is there, but the hangover persists, get a sleep study.
That would be my threshold. If you're consistently getting the hours and still feeling physically wrecked, don't just assume it's normal. It might be, but it might not be.
All right, I think we've given Daniel, and anyone else in the 6 a.m. wake-up club, a pretty thorough map of what's happening in their body.
Hopefully some reassurance that they're not imagining it. The clamminess is real. The heaviness is real. Your body is keeping score, and now you know what the scoreboard looks like. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1860s, a naturalist on the Isle of Lewis in the Outer Hebrides published a widely cited theory that the sundew plant's sticky tentacles were not for catching insects, but were actually a defensive mechanism to repel grazing sheep, and that the captured insects were purely accidental. This was considered the mainstream explanation for nearly 2 decades.
The entire scientific establishment looked at a plant actively dissolving bugs and said, probably just trying to keep the sheep away.
19th century botany was really out here doing fan fiction about plants.
Thank you, Hilbert. That was something. This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at My Weird Prompts. If you've got a question your body is asking that your brain can't quite articulate, send it our way. We'll dig into the physiology.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.